Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold, episode 77. If you are listening on the day we drop, it's March 4th, which is my aunt's birthday. So happy birthday, Aunt Janet, for March 5th JBJS issue. As always, the things you're going to hear in this podcast are our opinion and ours alone, myself being Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods, and I have with me
Antonia Chen, deputy editor for Adult Reconstruction.
And what we're talking about are what we think about these papers and not what the editor-in-chief or the other editors in the JBJS family of journals or the board of trustees think about these papers. Sometimes the takes are hot, intentionally so. We want people listening. We want people to double-click on these items themselves and read about it after we sort of, you know, give that kernel of intellectual stimulation. Make sure you give us a 5-star rating and be sure to subscribe. We're on Stitcher, Castos, Amazon, Apple, Spotify, wherever else you find your podcast, or just get it from jbjs.org. This episode of Your Case on Hold is brought to you by Think JBJS. So this is our new, we are Penn State, or I don't know. That's the one that comes to mind. So this is Think JBJS for all your needs. 100% 360 wraparound service in terms of what you need for your education, what you need for training, what you need for entertainment, what you need for intellectual stimulation. We've got podcasts. We have the flagship journal. We have the other journals in the family of JBJS publications. We have clinical classroom. We have the database with the images. We have getting your self-assessment exams. We have preparation for maintenance of certification. We have preparation for board certification. I mean, what more can you really ask for? There are many orthopedic journals, of course. There are none that are as great as JBJS. There are many orthopedic publications and promotions that do some of these things, or even a lot of these things, but they don't do all these things, and they don't do it at the level that JBJS does it. So when you're thinking about submitting a paper, or you're thinking about reading the best and greatest in orthopedic research, or you're thinking about entertainment in the orthopedic space, arts and humanities in orthopedics, when you're thinking about maintenance certification, when you're thinking about your board certification, when you are thinking about your web-based longitudinal assessment, when you're thinking about your CME, think JBJS. So with that said, let's head into the top of the pile. We have Let's Learn to Talk About Our Patients as If They Are Sitting Right in Front of Us by Harrison, which is permanently free. Then we have To Provide Care or To Care For, The Influence of Language on Medicine by Park. Next is 2 decades since the Unequal Treatment Report, The State of Racial, Ethnic, and Socioeconomic Disparities in Elective Total Hip and Knee Replacement Use by Tirukamaran and colleagues. Followed by Modern Management of Severe Open Fractures of the Extremities, The Role of the Induced Membrane Technique by Kanakaris and colleagues. Then we have Spine Abductor Syndrome, Novel Associations Between Lumbar Spine Disease and Hip Gluteal Muscle Pathology by Levu et al. And then Reoperations as an Outcome Indicator for Developmental Dysplasia of the Hip Treated at Walking Age by Chang and colleagues. And that also is permanently free. We're now moving into the headlines. What's latest and greatest in orthopedic news this week? My headline is Common Comorbidities and a Comparison of 4 Comorbidity Indices in Patients Undergoing Orthopedic Oncology Surgery by Patel and colleagues. So first author here, I didn't select this paper because he happened to have trained with us, but Shalin Patel is a graduate of our residency program. This is from him and his colleagues at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Hopefully he's listening. If you are, give us a 5-star rating.
And a high five.
And subscribe before you hear what I have to say about your work. So the premise here is that there are many options out there in terms of how you would want to characterize comorbidities. This is like March is the month of, it's comorbidity month in the orthopedic space, because there's actually some comorbidity articles that we're going to be discussing in the next issue. So if you like comorbidities and these types of controversies and discussions are your thing, then you're definitely going to want to tune into the next episode as well. So there are many options in the universe of getting comorbidities, describing comorbidities. And the premise here is that the best comorbidity scores are the ones that are most approximate to the population of interest. So they say, and I'm just reading from them here, the most effective comorbidity indices are those based on the specific populations being studied. Now, I don't exactly agree with that first. Happy to hear what you think about it. But what the way I think about comorbidity scores as someone who does research fairly regularly and research is a seminal part of like my everyday life, I feel like comorbidity scores are actually something that you want to have translate across different populations. Ultimately, it depends, of course, on what you're using it for. If you're using the comorbidity scores as like a covariate adjustment in an analysis, that's different than if you're trying to use a comorbidity score as something that's going to inform outcomes, like you're going to use it as a prognostic model or something like that. So I will say that there is some room for, you know, personal preference as far as what you're going to use and when you're going to use it, but it really comes down to what the underlying intent is. And frankly, most of the time when we see these comorbidity scores, be it the Charlson or the Ehlichhauser, those are two of the more common ones. And then they have some other ones here, the Van Wall-Raven and the AHRQ. If you're using them to inform recommendations for care in a niche group of patients, then certainly, yes, that could be a little bit different. But most of the time, and certainly in studies, we're seeing it as sort of a benchmark for a way of efficiently representing a group of patients and presenting their particular comorbidity set that's going to be, or the comorbidity burden that's going to be sort of uniform amongst individuals. And that's what you have with these popular categories, the Charlson or the Ehlichhauser. Those are the two most popular ones. They also use the National Institute of Aging, National Cancer Institute Index, the Van Wall-Raven, and the AHRQ Index. And then there are also differences between the count and the score, so to speak. So we, in our research, we just use the count because the scores are somewhat antiquated. Like the Charlson, I think, goes back to like 1987. And then there's a Deo modification in the early 1990s. And just the simplest example that I give about like how these scores are you know, somewhat problematic if you're trying to use them in the exact way in which they were developed is the situation of HIV or AIDS, which are components of the comorbidity count or score. Now, the impact of having HIV or AIDS in 1987, when there was no antiretroviral treatment or really very limited treatment, and even in some respects, limited understanding of the disease itself that was sort of evolving from the 80s into the, you know, earlier, even the mid 90s, but certainly in no way were the medications available for treatment reflective of what we have now in 2025 or even 10 years ago. So the antiretrovirals were really a major game changer in terms of treatment and survival and outlook for patients who were diagnosed with HIV or AIDS. If you're using the actual weighted comorbidity score from 1987, it's going to look at HIV and AIDS differently than if you're using it in the current environment and you're talking about someone who's on antiretrovirals and has like a viral count of zero, right? Like, so you can't treat them like it's 1987. You can't look at them like it's 1987. And that's the problem with these kinds of comorbidity scores. And I they're illustrating that in an academic way here, because basically in their population, which was three different types of cancer populations here, they have three subsets: malignant primary bone tumors, malignant primary soft tissue tumors, and then osseous metastatic disease. And their conclusion is the prevalence of many comorbidities in patients undergoing orthopedic oncology surgery is greater than those reported in other patient populations. And as a result, because of sort of the ubiquity of the high levels of comorbidities, there was little to no correlation between comorbidities and patient outcomes in our patient population. So what that essentially amounts to is if you have a population with a very high number of comorbidities, what distinguishes between someone who's going to have a complication or not is not the comorbidity. It's some other. There are other factors that you're going to have to...
It's the problem they're being diagnosed with in the first place.
Yeah, of course. Now, you know, from a methodology standpoint, one of the things that I'm most unsure about in this context and just really didn't resonate with me is that they had 6,800 orthopedic oncology surgeries performed in the time period that they could consider. So they had 6,800 patients that they could choose from. And what they did was they just took a random sample of 100 patients in each of those three cohorts. So out of 6,800, you only selected 300. And I don't see like a good rationale for that. Certainly, you don't have to abstract 6,800 cases, but I feel like you need more than just 100 in each of those categories to really give us a good broad appreciation. We talk about capturing the extant variation in the universe of the population of interest in sufficient numbers that you can really say you have a good cross-section of the data set in a way that's going to allow for translation and generalization. And I don't think you can really make that case with just 300 patients. So that seems like a self-inflicted misstep that may be driving the fact that, you know, ultimately it's almost like they were underpowered to detect the impact of comorbidities. I mean, that's essentially what they're saying. At the end of the day, to distill down what, you know, based on their finding, they were likely underpowered. It's not that you can't find it. If you were doing individual comorbidity counts and you have sufficient numbers of patients, first off, no one in this data set, because there's already a diagnosis of cancer, is going to have zero comorbidities. There's no zero comorbidity patient in this cohort. It doesn't exist in this condition. But if you had, you know, 100 patients with 2 and 100 with 3 and 100 with 4 and 100 with 5 and 100 with 6, all the way up to, I think like the Ellickhauser considers 21 different. And depending on which variation of the Charleston you're using, it's like 15 to 18. So even if, you know, let's just say you had, instead of just taking a random sample of 300 patients, 100 in each category, you actually randomly sampled within the permutations of the comorbidity categories. Even if you didn't want to do by one, you know, like you did like 2 to 3 and 4 to 6 or something like that, and you randomly sampled and pulled until you like filled those buckets, I think that could provide a very different outlook. At the end of the day, it's an academic discussion. And, you know, what they found is essentially it's a high comorbid population, and they were probably underpowered to actually show which of these comorbidity scores. I don't think comorbidity scores should really be used to prognosticate outcomes. They've been shown to be pretty blunt instruments that way. They're just a better way to efficiently encapsulate the comorbidity burden for a body of patients. Also, with some of these, there are like some things that are considered to be protective. Those same variables may not translate to patients with oncologic disease burden. So I think it's good for research. I don't think it potentially informs patient care or clinical practice.
But that's what this is about, research. I guess it's a win in some ways. So I'm with you and I agree with you when it comes to comorbidity indexes, which is your go-to, by the way, for your research, because I know you said you do a lot of this care.
We typically do Charleston, the Dale modification of Charleston. That's my preferred. And then for some of like the stuff that we do with Medicare, we'll go with Ellickhauser. There is evidence supporting that if you're going off of claims-based data, that Ellickhauser maybe is better. I mean, it's not like you should go with what you're familiar with and what works for you. I think it's more important that you're doing something to account for the comorbidity burden than which one of these you actually end up choosing. There are pluses and minuses for all of them.
But try using them. They are good and useful to have, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, certainly if you're doing, you know, what we colloquially refer to as big data studies, I think it's expected that you're going to have some type of efficient comorbidity adjustment. You're going to characterize the comorbidity burden of those patients. It's good to do, I think, in any research context, even if it's a randomized trial or something where comorbidities conceivably could impact the outcome. You can't go wrong adjusting for the comorbidity burden, basically.
It's a good thing to do.
Right, yes, exactly.
So I'm with you. All right.
All right. Now, talking about randomized trials, your headline, efficacy of platelet-rich plasma versus placebo for the treatment of greater trochanteric pain syndrome, a double-blinded randomized controlled trial by Achia and colleagues, 30 days free. Tell us what's up.
All right. So greater trochanteric pain is not just greater trochanteric bursitis, which we typically equate it with. So this study looked at greater trochanteric pain syndrome, which is developed with potential causes including gluteus medius tendonitis or gluteus minimus tendonitis, muscle tears, trigger points, and iliotibial band disorders. To be honest, there's really not great options when it comes to treating greater trochanteric pain syndrome. Typically, you start off with physical therapy, anti-inflammatories, stretching, strengthening, all that sort of stuff. And if that doesn't work, then you go to corticosteroid injections. There have been more studies that look at ultrasound-guided leukocyte-rich, platelet-rich plasma injections, sometimes used for lateral epicondylitis. It's been useful in that area. So this study said, let's randomize patients who have this the greater trochanteric pain syndrome to receive either an ultrasound-guided, leukocyte-rich, platelet-rich plasma injection or a placebo, which is 0.9% saline solution. And they did this in a double-blinded manner, meaning the patient was blinded to it and the assessor was blinded to it. The person doing the procedure itself was obviously not blinded to it because they had to draw the blood and things like that. Now, what they did is this, they call this the HIPPO trial, which I like as a term, the hip injections PRP versus placebo trial. And all injections were performed under ultrasound guidance and the trochanteric bursa and the gluteus medius tendon. And they did this for both placebo and non-placebo. These were adult patients with a chronic history of this greater trochanteric pain syndrome of greater than 6 months duration who failed non-operative management, including physiotherapy and steroid injections. So these are people who were recalcitrant to the other treatment options. All participants had a clinical diagnosis of the GTPS, which is the greater trochanteric pain syndrome, confirmed by an MRI scan as reported by the radiology department, or if a patient couldn't get an MRI, they had an ultrasound scan confirming this. And there was tendon degeneration was assessed on a 4-grade classification, and only patients with grade 1 or 2, either bursitis or gluteal tendinopathy, were included. If it was higher than that, they were excluded just because they probably wouldn't benefit from this if they had spine or hip joint arthritis or any previous hip surgery or surgery for the GTPS. The blinding was maintained throughout the whole process, which I appreciate. And the placebo group, they actually had their blood drawn like they would if they were getting the PRP. And the blood sample was taken to another room for 20 minutes to simulate the PRP centrifuge time. And there was a drape that obscured the hip and treatment area from the patient's line of sight. So they couldn't see if the solution was being injected then was clear versus the redness from a PRP injection, or if it's, it depends on what it looks like. Anyway, all these injections were done by a rheumatologist under ultrasound guidance, and patients had a few outcomes. The main outcome was this International Hip Outcome Tool 12. And they use a visual analog scale for pain, the modified Harris hip score, and the EuroQOL 5, EQ5D, that's the quality of life questionnaire, and the presence and absence of complications. And they were collected at baseline, 3, 6, and 12 months. And they were compared between the PRP and the placebo group. And a previous power calculation showed that you needed a sample size of 66 or 33 in each group. And the study was run as a superiority trial. The patient population included 84 patients that were recruited and randomized. 2 people withdrew from the placebo group, 2 withdrew from the PRP group, and an additional patient was ineligible. So there was a final cohort of 79 patients, with 39 in the PRP group and 40 in the placebo group. So there was an adequate number of patients based on the sample size calculation. Both groups generally had improvement from baseline to 12 months. But the authors did state that the only deterioration in scores compared to baseline was seen in the PRP group. For the first assessment, the International Hip Outcome Tool at 12 months, the EQ5D index at 3 and 6 months, and the EQ5D VAS at all follow-up points. So those are a lot of points for essentially that the deterioration of scores for the PRP was worse than baseline. So it seems like the PRP actually did worse than the placebo at multiple different points. But there was no statistically significant difference between the two groups at any follow-up points. They did do a sensitivity analysis, and they conducted a multivariable linear regression model that adjusted for age, sex, body mass index, and preoperative baseline score. And it showed no difference or no significant associations between the first international hip score and the EQ5D score gains at 12 months in treatment. So there was no immediate complications or side effects, and participants had minimal discomfort during the procedure. No long-term complications were identified at the 12-month follow-up. So in conclusion, this was a randomized controlled trial, and we know how difficult these can be to do. So it's very nice that they did one and they used placebo and truly used placebo in a way where they simulated the exact same steps in both areas. But they found really no difference for up to 6 months. They actually went up to 12 months of following patients under some fallout. That said, since there was no difference, they did appropriately conclude that they don't support the routine use of PRP for the treatment of greater trochanteric pain syndrome. So what I commend the authors for is publishing a null hypothesis result, right? That there was no difference between the two groups, and the data shows what the data shows. So I do appreciate that, and I appreciate the randomized controlled trial, but it might even seem that the PRP might be worse off than placebo, so I would not recommend using this in patients.
Across the board from the RCT piece, definitely no concerns, and the conclusions are valid as stated. The one thing that I feel is necessary to point out from a method standpoint, just so somebody doesn't look at this and then say, oh yeah, this is how you should do it, is when it comes to their regression model. So first off, and we do see this a lot. So again, it's not unique to this particular study, and many people make this misstep. When you do a power calculation for a randomized controlled trial, that power calculation tends to be based on the simple bivariate comparison that's assuming randomized adjustment across the two cohorts. And there's no evidence to assume that that was not the case. So they got 79 patients. That does not mean that now you have a population that's suited to a logistic regression model. If your intent, or a linear regression model either, any regression model, if your intent is to use regression for whatever reason, and honestly, that really shouldn't be the, if you have an RCT, you shouldn't have to do a regression model, because again, there should be just the intent of the randomized trial is that there's going to be balance between the cohorts. If there's not, or if you don't think there's going to be, you have to build in the numbers to support your regression model, and they don't have that here. So for a regression model, you want to have, for a continuous outcome variable, which is what they're doing, you need to have 20 patients per event. And if it's actually going to be a conservative assessment, the most robust will also account for the intercept. So here they have age, sex, body mass index, preoperative baseline score, and then we'll add for the intercept. So they should have 120, between 100 and 120 patients or something to that effect. And they only had 79 patients. Second, and also of interest and importance here, these outcomes, the EQ5D and the IHOT-12, these are not, would not be expected to have continuous, or rather a normal distribution for continuous data. We would expect non-parametric appearance, which violates the assumptions of linear regression, which is all well and good. And people would be like, oh, you know, here he is talking about like all this stuff. But it actually makes a difference if you're applying linear regression and the model assumes that all these other things are there when they're not really there, then you get incorrect assessments. You get spurious point estimates, you get spurious 95% confidence intervals, and things can be showing as not significant when they are significant. Models would be over-optimistic when you have fewer patients than you're supposed to have. And also what really it comes down to is that a lot of these findings, the confidence interval is going to be too wide for them to detect a difference, again, because of issues within the sample. The sample was created for a bivariate comparison, not for a multivariable comparison. And that's
agreed. And that's why I appreciate your methodology viewpoint on that.
All right. Now we're going to get into really what's going on hold or what isn't. The multidimensional approach for predicting 30-day mortality in patients with a hip fracture. Development and external validation of the Rotterdam hip fracture mortality prediction 30 days, also abbreviated RHMP. I would pronounce it like RUMP, I guess, 30. This is by Dehan and colleagues with an infographic and permanently free. So definitely, you know, check it out yourselves if you have the chance. This is a study where they took two prospectively collected registries, of hip fracture databases from two different hospitals. One they used as a training cohort, the other they used as a testing cohort. In total, they had 3,523 patients analyzed. Their goal, to develop a predictive model for 30-day mortality in the setting of hip fractures. Their approach was using an adaptive least absolute shrinkage and selection operator, otherwise called LASSO, logistic regression. The overall approach kind of aligns with sort of the machine learning with testing and a validate or development training cohort and a testing cohort, or some people call it a testing and a validation cohort, whatever. Those are semantics. But at the end of the day, this does have kind of that veneer of machine learning about it. First, when we're talking about developing, you know, prognostic tools or prognostic models, you know, the things that we generally think about are, one, is it easy to understand? Two, is it easy to use? Three, does it inform care? As we'll go through here, I don't think it's that easy to understand. Most machine learning constructs are not. Two, that also adds into it, maybe it's not that easy to use. Three, does it inform care? And in the setting of hip fractures, I mean, if we're not talking about like a small avulsion off of the greater troch, if we're talking about real deal femoral neck displaced fractures or intertrochanteric fractures, these are almost always surgically managed, with very, very rare exceptions. And those are going to be, the patient is so frail, so ill, that it's not anticipated that they're going to survive the operative episode. In which case, I feel like in those situations where I've seen them, the patient is actually going into hospice at that point. Another is, you know, where the patient has such severe dementia or something like that. I mean, it's all sort of within the worldview, the outlook of like advanced frailty, difficulty, you know, just surviving the hospital admission, the operative procedure, something like that. More often than not, there doesn't need to be a decision about whether or not these are going to be managed operatively. And certainly for patients where it is sort of weighing in the balance, the discussion is, you know, if it's not treated surgically, they will not mobilize. They're going to have more pain. And this has been borne out in a number of other studies. And then, you know, it leads to a cascade of events that ultimately result in more mortality. At some point, we, through our decades work that you and I have worked on together, although you weren't on this particular paper on the hip fractures, where we use Medicare data to look at patients with dementia, those who were selected for non-operative management for whatever reason, because dementia issues, they did very poorly. And that was published in JAMA Open. So the need for a prognostic tool to tell patients who's going to, or tell families, tell caregivers, tell surgeons who's going to survive at 30 days or not, especially when you're only limiting, as they did, to operative cases, is obviously not going to apply to the patients who probably really need that parameter to be particularly defined for them. So there's some, you know, selection and indication bias here. But ultimately, you know, that this is all patients who underwent a hemiarthroplasty between 2011 and 2016. And those with a proximal hip fracture between 2018 and 2021, they go through a standard machine learning application. Problems with machine learning, oftentimes you're considering more predictors in the models than you have patients with the outcome of interest. 302 patients died within 30 days of surgery. That does seem, you know, like a good number, but yet they included 26 candidate predictors, which generally means if you had all those in the model at the same time, you actually need 520 mortality events. We just went over that in the last one, but it's using the same concepts. So it may be that these models are over-optimistic. Some people that work in machine learning, and we've talked about this in other studies, tend to ignore that. And they're just like, oh, it's machine learning, so it doesn't have to follow any rules. Where we're going, there are no rules, like they say in Back to the Future, right? No, they say no roads, but no rules anyway, but that isn't true. machine learning doesn't solve all problems. And I think that is a particular issue here. And it may mean that these findings are really just identifying, making a lot of different comparisons to find the specific issues at hand within this category of patients. And then the problem is that doesn't necessarily translate to your patient at your hospital in some other part of the world or some other city somewhere else. Ultimately, they came up with age, gender, which we'll assume they mean biologic sex, but American Society of Anesthesiologists score, dementia, albumin level, the CATS index of independence and activities of daily living total score, and residence in a nursing home. So none of the factors that they identified actually would seem, you know, that surprising. Certainly dementia, low serum albumin, residence in a nursing home. If you have low levels, you're non-mobile. If you have high comorbidity burden, and if you're more advanced age, the likelihood of mortality is going to be higher. It's probably going to be higher whether you had the hip fracture or not, right? So again, when you're including patients only who had surgery, that right there is a selection bias. They recognize this and say patients who were treated non-operatively were excluded because we wanted to investigate the risk factors for mortality following hip fracture surgery. I feel like some reviewer or methods editor asked them about that. And we've talked about those kinds of responses before. They're very unfulfilling, where it's kind of like, yes, if you had the other counterfactual, the model would be more informative. And the response is, well, yeah, but we only wanted to look at this. We just wanted to do this thing. So, you know, at the end result, that does draw back from the ultimate utility, generalizability, translational capacity of this particular model. They listed as a strength, they said the cohorts were representative of the target population and had limited missing data, increasing the external validity of our model. I don't agree with that statement. Like, the fact that you have limited missing data doesn't add external validity of your model. If you had complete data on a very niche group of patients with very specific parameters, and you had 100% complete data, that's not going to mean it's going to translate to some other. External validity means that what you found is going to hold up in New York City, it's going to hold up in Zimbabwe, it's going to hold up in Hong Kong, it's going to hold up in Dubai, it's going to hold up in Chennai, India, it's going to hold up in Kerala, it's going to hold up in Australia. That's what external validity means. And the fact that you had 100% data captured, that doesn't mean that it's going to hold up elsewhere. I also disagree. You know, they emphasized this was prospective registry data collection. At the end of the day, all clinical care is prospective. This is a retrospective review. Their approach, if you're running a machine learning model, that in and of itself speaks to this being a retrospective data set. I don't agree that this is level two evidence. I would call it level three. And the last thing is that when you're doing these sorts of things and you're saying hospital A, and then we tested in hospital B, and the results are the same, so this is proof of an external validation, it depends on how you look at it, because it's not necessarily proof it works anywhere. It's just proof that it works in hospital B. And that could just be that hospital B has similar outcomes and treatment selection as hospital A. It could be a misinterpretation or erroneous attribution of the findings. If hospital A and hospital B are very, very similar, they share the same surgeons. If we're talking about Brigham and Women's Hospital and Mass General Hospital in Massachusetts, in Boston, and you do a study at Brigham and then you look at the patients at Mass General and they have the same outcomes and results and your scoring system performs well for the one or the other, I wouldn't say that that means it's externally validated. I would say that what you're seeing is that those two hospitals are basically indistinguishable from each other. So at the end of the day, if you have interest in using this model, and for the authors as well, I'd encourage them to test it again in a completely different context and environment, using data from the US or using data from another part of the world that you could have access to and see how it performs. But ultimately, I think its application is in question, because by and large, you don't, no matter what this told you, you're probably going to still be offering surgery for these patients, knowing what we know about the condition.
Right. It's one of those things where you're going to be undergoing surgery just because it's the right thing for the patient and it reduces all the complications and morbidity.
It gives them the best chance. It gives them the best chance. I mean, so many, you know, with the exception of hemiarthroplasty, so many of the hip fracture procedures nowadays are really minimally invasive. Small incision, limited blood loss. Some of them you can do with epidural anesthesia. Like, the patient doesn't even need to be completely...
It's not bad at all. So I'm with you. Even with the hemis are actually pretty minimally invasive too. You can do them DA. You know, you can do all these things that we typically do for a total hip anyway. So it's a better outcome for the patient.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
All right. So what, I mean, I would say this is on hold for now. If you validate it, in certain circumstances, it may be applicable, but right now it is on hold. Let's get into
the enjoy time with anesthesia.
Yeah. Yeah. Anesthesia said the patient is probably, this is one of the ones that can't go. They did your score and they found that the risk was too high. Honorable mention, intraoperative tranexamic acid infusion reduces perioperative blood loss in pediatric limb salvage surgeries, a double-blinded randomized placebo-controlled trial by Elbanamian colleagues, 30 days free with a comment, so you don't have to take it from us. This study included 48 participants and was conducted, I believe, in Cairo University in Egypt. So some good international work. Ultimately, they found TXA can be safely infused intraoperatively in children and adolescents undergoing limb salvage surgery and help significantly in reducing perioperative blood loss and transfusion requirements, similar to what's been shown for that medication in other settings. Then we have the risk of postoperative periprosthetic femoral fracture after total hip arthroplasty depends more on stem design than cement use, an analysis of national health data from England by Lamb and colleagues with a comment and visual summary. Dr. Lamb and their team produce a lot of work out of this registry in England. This is a cohort study of patients who underwent primary total hip arthroplasty over the course of 2004 to 2020. They are looking for periprosthetic femoral fractures, and this occurred less than 1%, 0.6% of the time, but was still 5,100 episodes in almost 810,000 cases. And similar to other studies, cemented stems were associated with the lowest risk. Some cementless stem designs outperformed modern cemented stem designs. Stem design was strongly associated with the risk. I think that, in other work, the use of a collar for the uncemented makes a big difference. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Uncemented is definitely makes a difference versus cemented. Although I will say it depends on stem geometry. That's one of the biggest things that he says. And again, that as they're hinting at here, more in stem design. And it's one of those things where the newer stem models, where they have like a triple taper wedge or things like that, are different than the older ones. And that can make a difference in terms of fixation.
So definitely advancements on the forefront of improving patient care. All right, the last one, surgery for olecranon fractures in the elderly. Results of the SOFI randomized controlled trial by Joshi and colleagues with a comment and infographic and permanently free. The last one hits the JBJS trifecta. This is a multi-center pragmatic randomized controlled trial across 24 hospitals in Australia and New Zealand. 60 participants randomized, and the study found no significant difference in DASH scores at 12 months between operative and non-operative cohorts. This supports non-operative treatment as a reasonable option for displaced stable olecranon fractures in elderly patients. I think this is an area of certainly controversy when I was in training. So something that's definitely adding to the literature, improving patient care and practice. We are about out of time. Thanks for bearing with us. If you like what you heard, like and subscribe and come back in 2 weeks. If you didn't like what you heard, thanks for listening to me drone on for this long. I really did enjoy it. And, next time, Dr. Chen will be leading the discussion. So be sure to stop in. Hopefully, wherever you are, your cases are all on green and go. But where we are here, your case is forever on hold.
On hold. Thanks, all.